You are listening to another Screenfish One-on-One, this time live with writer-director Darius Marder. Marder's latest film is called The Sound of Metal, and it tells the story of Ruben, a heavy metal drummer who loses his hearing all of a sudden and is forced to learn what it means to be a part of the deaf community. In this one-on-one, we get to speak to Marder about how a film like this has changed him personally, the film's incredible and creative use of sound design, and the difference between stillness and silence. Welcome to the conversation. Welcome to Screenfish. Hi, how are you? I'm glad to chat with you. I don't say this very often. In fact, I don't think I've ever said this about a film. This isn't just one of the best films I've seen this year. It's the best film I've seen at least in the last 2 years.
Oh, man.
That's outrageous and really means a lot to me. Thank you.
Well, I mean, I saw it when it came out at TIFF, and it just, I'm not exaggerating, it blew me away. I'm very, very impressed. It was incredible work.
Well, that's very meaningful to me. I mean, it, you know, when you spend as long as I've spent building this film, it's not lost on me when it hits people. It really isn't, because it just validates why you're doing it. And I did spend many, many years feeling crazy. So it's remarkable to have it hit the world and to hear that. So thank you.
Oh, I mean every word. And maybe, can you tell us, where did the idea come from? What was it that began the journey of Sound of Metal?
Well, Sound of Metal grew out of my relationship. Actually, it goes back to 13 years ago when I met Derek C in France. And he and I became great friends, and we've written a lot together and made a lot of things. But the very first thing we talked about was this movie. And at the time, I say this movie, it wasn't this movie yet, but at the time, Derek was shooting this documentary of Jucifer. And Jucifer is this incredible band made up of two people, a couple who kind of endlessly drive the road in their Winnebago and play loud, loud music. So it grew from that. I eventually ended up taking that and needing to write it and kind of, I very quickly, you know, Derek's such an awesome filmmaker, and he had shot just this beautiful stuff. And I just kind of early on felt this, I was drawn to the relationship. I was drawn to the codependence of this couple, the metaphor of a band and a coupledom and relationship. And also this sound opportunity in this was just like kind of rocked me. I saw it early and I was like, oh man, there's a cinematic potential here that needs to be explored, and it has to be written, because the sound concept I saw early on, but I knew that the story had to earn that. You know, you couldn't just rely on it. It had to earn it. That story had to be utterly intact in order to use that technology and use that very powerful and empathetic language.
Mm. I would love to talk to you about the sound design too, about the film, because it's so unique. I mean, so often in film, we've seen it played with slightly, where, you know, I think back to Private Ryan as an example, when a bomb goes off and you hear the high pitch, but it's just for a moment. But this is a film that uses sound design almost as its own language.
Yeah.
Including the cochlear implant towards the end. So what was it that you were really wanting to express through that?
Well, you know, most films have a fairly omniscient perspective, which is to say, like, maybe a third person narration where they can go anywhere. You know, almost all films do. You know, you can cut anywhere, you can do anything. And then sometimes within those films, like you were saying, like Saving Private Ryan, you might have a scene where they try to thrust, or they do thrust you into a place in a particular setting where you're like, you're quickly empathizing with that character via sound design. And we've seen that a lot. We've seen bombs go off and there's that thing, you know, and gunshots and this and that, and a moment of that. But when you have an omniscient perspective, when you can go and into anything and cut all over the place, you aren't committing to a language, you know, you're not committing to a very, very specific perspective, of course. And this film has this, like, we committed early to this first person, or at one stage in the writing, to this first person perspective, which is really grueling, you know, because it's like, you're in it, you're in Ruben's perspective, and you can't cut away, and you can't go over here, and you can't go over there, you are here. And then it was about, okay, how do we deepen that perspective? How do we push the boundaries of perspective, you know, and literally like a point of hearing? How do we enter into that? And what might that do for us cinematically? We spend so much time in movies in general dealing with point of view. People have dealt with point of view a lot, and even some first person points of views, like Diving Bell and the Butterfly, that where you're locked in this person's head, you know, and you can only see through one eye. We've been in point of view a lot, but not point of hearing. And this film is kind of like rigidly interested in that, even insofar as it doesn't, and this was on purpose with the cinema, doesn't push the point of view, even at times when it could, you know, instead really, really just commits to that point of hearing.
Yeah, it's a remarkable way to tell the story, and especially sort of brings you into this community and into this world. Thinking about that, actually, I was wondering if you could talk to me a little bit about your preparation for bringing the deaf community to life on screen. We've seen deaf actors, deaf roles, but the portraying the community itself is something so unique to the film.
Well, the deaf community really represents itself in this film. Mm-hmm. You know, that's how I approached it. I approached it as, you know, a privilege, basically, to be invited into deaf culture. And, you know, I knew that I was for years and years and years committed to only casting within deaf culture. And that was something that wasn't negotiable. But even selfishly so, because I knew that was the best movie. You know, if you're after truth, why on earth would you fake that? It's just remarkable what people will fake in a movie when there's such truer versions. And of course, within the deaf community, there are just outrageously talented actors, outrageously talented people that don't often get the chance to be seen and perform. And the movie is from the perspective of a hearing person who is kind of invited into deaf culture. And in a way, we all do that as hearing audiences when we watch this movie. Because we don't understand ASL at first. When Ruben doesn't understand it, we're just invited in, and we have to kind of contend with that being a minority. And that, in it, to answer your question, is how I approached it. I, you know, this is a new world for me too, to some degree. I mean, I dedicated it to my grandmother because she was deaf, but she wasn't culturally deaf. She didn't know ASL. She was late deafened. And so I came in with that as well. And I asked, you know, I went to the deaf community members of in Brooklyn, and, you know, Riz and I both actually started learning ASL together, although I had to, you know, at that time I couldn't do it like he did. I mean, he took an incredibly deep dive. Mm. And you know, we got tight with some members of the Brooklyn deaf community and the New York deaf community, and Jeremy Stone, actually, who taught Riz sign language. He's in the movie as the ASL teacher. And he, you know, Ruben's last name is Stone, which is kind of a nod to Jeremy. And Ruben and Riz went to Jeremy's wedding. And so we did a lot of kind of really able to step within that community. And then when I was casting, I was spending a lot of time with the Boston deaf community and various deaf communities within Massachusetts. And that was really incredible too. And the whole process of building this community together was just, it was just magical and such an honor.
I don't know if I can ask this or not, or if this is too big, but one of the things I was in, the way you just said there, How does a film like this change you? I mean, as you said, your experience with the deaf community was limited. I think that's fair to say before this process. Is there any sort of change that you felt about yourself about this film?
100%. I mean, it changed me in so many ways from the very first time. Well, going back to writing it to the point of putting it through production, and I mean, my entire life shifted because of this movie. It ushered in like a whole new aspect of myself, and I think that there's a lot of me in this movie. It's a very, very personal movie to me, but the very at the heart of the movie, this idea of acceptance and this idea of sitting and being present was really a practice for me in the making of the movie. And the great gift of the deaf community is that you have to be present when you talk with a deaf person. You have to be present because it's a visual language. And if you can't be sitting here on your phone like all of us hearing people do while we talk to people. You cannot do that. In fact, you really can't be doing anything else. It's physical and it's visual. So it requires, and then not only that, but 50% of the language is emotional in your face. So you have to get good with actually externalizing emotion. And that's something particularly that I think, you know, we have a hard time doing is hearing people. You know, people say, how you doing? We say, good. You know, like, what about my good? Nothing. No, we're very used to that. As Riz says that he heard from someone within the deaf community, we hide behind our words. So I think that, you know, one of the things that was really remarkable and maybe changed me during the process was that focus of presence, of just being present in the time that we were shooting, in the prep, and just really taking it in and enjoying it and breathing into it some life rather than trying to control it. And, it's so easy to do that in filmmaking, is to fall into that kind of control spiral because there's so much at stake. But it's this great paradox, you know, in filmmaking, where if you try too hard to control it, you'll kill it. And that, it turns out, is at the heart of what the movie's about. So this very thing that I was practicing, I found there was this really meta aspect to the making of the movie, and it did change me, and in a funny way, maybe prepared me for this pandemic.
Yeah, that's true. I'm so glad that you brought up that aspect of it, though, because I mean, for me, the emotional mental bomb that went off in this film is when Riz is talking to Paul, and Paul simply says, in all that time that you were silent, or that you were sitting, were you ever really still? And I was wondering, can you talk about the difference between those two things, stillness and silence, and why is that such a changing space?
Well, that's the essence of the film, is begging us to ask us, like, if there is something scary about the film, is it really scary because of the deafness, or is it scary because of the silence, or is it scary, or is it just here? Yeah. Is that what's scary all along, you know? And, so that's essentially it. It's asking that core question of, you know, if you're never dealing with this, you know, I think a lot about toxic masculinity and our discussions around toxic masculinity, which I'm very interested in, and kind of shows up in everything I've ever written. But when I think of toxic masculinity, and my understanding of it is the way in which men are toxic to themselves, poison themselves. I think that's how originally that phrase was used. It wasn't really about hurting others, and Ruben never hurts anybody else. Mm. You know, he's a protector, he's a caretaker. But his the trappings of how he sits with himself, what he expects of himself, what he cannot express, what he has to hide, what he has to run from, what he has to fix, who he has to save, all of those have to's become his toxic to himself. And they are the monster, and they are lurking. So that is, for someone who deals in that space, a silent room is a hell. It's a hell zone. And that's what's incredible about it, is how a silent room, an utterly innocuous space, can be either beautiful, sublime, or it can be a hell. And I think that you do see that reflected at some point in this film when you see the actual dichotomy of that.
Oh my gosh, yeah. I can't even begin to tell you how much that resonated with me. And absolutely, there's this internal and external tension about that moment that sort of you can see at play. And speaking of Riz's performance, which is remarkable, by the way.
I agree. I think he's just so great.
He really is. But with one of the conversations I think that we see, again, going back to Riz and Paul, he right after he gets the implants, he says, "You sound like an addict." He said, but there's something about his character that sure, he's a recovering addict as well, but he seems addicted to his past. And I was wondering, can you talk a little bit about that idea? Do you think it's possible to be addicted to the past?
I think it's possible to be addicted to the future too. You know, it's possible to be addicted to everything that isn't right here and right now. You know, that we're either clamoring for our past or clamoring for a future, but that's the issue, is that there's only one thing that we are, and that is what we are right now. And that play on the word fix is very intentional in the movie. You know, you have a heroin addict that is looking for a fix the whole movie. And, you know, you never see a drug, but yes, I think it's entirely possible that we are addicted. I think we all deal with this. I think the pandemic has brought it up for everyone. Like, what are we addicted to? How do we do when you remove all of our identities and all of the relationships that we thought we had to the past and to the future, and an unknown future? How do we deal with that? How do we contend with that? And many people can't. There's been a huge uptick in drug use, you know, and for good reason. So yeah, I think the film is really talking about addiction in a very broad way. And remember, codependence, there's a reason there's Codependence Anonymous too. You know, that's another form of addiction that people have to break. So that the subset of that personality shows its face in ways other than a needle.
You make the most of a little bit of dialogue every time someone speaks. And I just think it's an incredible film. And I really, really do appreciate you taking the time to chat with me.
Well, me too. Thanks so much for the kind words. Really appreciate it.
Well, I mean it. And thank you so much.
All right. You too. Stay safe.
You too.